ANZ Voices welcomes you to the Business of Bloodstock podcast with your co-hosts, Justin Darcy and Charmaine Phelan.
Welcome to episode 34 of the Business of Bloodstock podcast, proudly sponsored by Morgan and English Lawyers. I'm Justin Darcy, and joining me today is co-host Charmaine Phelan, along with our special guest, Ed Stapleton. Ed is a name and a face that many of us in the industry know and love, but what some may not know is how he found his way into Bloodstock and his drive to create his successful agency service. Attending sales all over the globe, basing himself out of New Zealand and with over 400 winners sourced from the sales since 2017, Ed now finds himself having a chat to us on this podcast. Ed, welcome to the Business of Bloodstock.
Thank you very much, Justin. I've learned some information about myself there, and that you've done your research. Thank you. Delighted to be here. Delighted to be on your podcast.
Fantastic, Ed. Well, we'll jump straight in. Tell us a little bit about your background with horses. When did you first begin in the industry overall?
Sure. Well, I'm not from a family background, family racing background at all, as Justin correctly points out. However, I can pinpoint the time and date that I fell in love with horse racing. It was March 12th, 1996, about 3:30 in the afternoon. And the reason that resonates so well with me is because that was the time that the Champion Hurdle took off in 1996. And at about 3:20 in the afternoon in school, a big TV was rolled into our classroom, and that was always the sign of something exciting was about to happen. And it was for this particular event. And the reason it was important, the rural school that I went to, which was in Boris County, Carlow in Ireland, we had a sort of a school connection to a horse running in the race called Denoli. He would become known as the sort of the people's champion in Ireland, but even as far back as 1996. And he had, the previous year, he had won the Sun Alliance Hurdle, which is the 2.5 mile race at Cheltenham. Now, frankly, as a 12-year-old, it was also going on in the background of my life. But when this particular event happened, when he took part in this, it was an amazing event. The school came together to watch it, and he only finished fourth. And it was the fact that he only finished fourth, that this almost greatness was there. If he had won, I really don't know how we would have reacted to this, or how the community would have reacted to this, because this was such a monumental event. Nowadays, of course, Willie Mullins wins it for sport, and he's also a neighbour, which is in the next village of Bagnallstown, which is about 20 kilometres where I'm from. About 12 kilometres to where I'm from. But that particular time, Denoli was trained by a small farmer come horse trainer. He did not have many horses in his stable at all. And it was the entire country just got behind him. The previous year, when he had won the Sun Alliance, he famously met the Queen, and he wasn't wearing a tie. And this was the big news that was about this particular man. So very grounded, down to earth man. But it sowed in me a seed of this great sport, this phenomenal sort of poetry in motion of these horses going over these fences, and then the opportunity to achieve greatness from very little. You know, the background of this man was not particularly. It was nothing, as I say. He was just a farmer. And the owner of the horse was an infamous man in our extended community who was a bone setter by trade, a self-taught bone setter who solved many ailments for people. But he was the owner of this horse, and it was a fantastic story. And then I followed on from there in that I grew up in a sheep farm in Ireland. And after this event, I loved the idea of the horse. And I asked my parents if we could get a pony, and they obliged. And we had a pony for riding to gather up the sheep, which was fantastic. And that quickly progressed then from which was March to 1996 to the following February 1997. I asked my mother if I could go work at the local stables where they rode out every day, because I wanted to, you know, be a jockey. Now, in hindsight, considering I'm now 6 foot tall and not exactly a small jockey sized man, that was a bit of an idea. But at the time, I was a skinny teenager, and this was a fantastic idea. And they fully supported this. And I went working for a local gentleman called Andrew Kavanagh and his son Morgan Kavanagh, which were in Boris House, about 4 kilometres from where I lived. And I thoroughly enjoyed it. I worked there in the school holidays. And the summer of 1997, I worked there, and all of June and all the, the whole month of June. And then unfortunately on the 1st of July, 1997, I had a bit of an accident. I got a kick in the forehead from a horse that I was loading onto a walker, and essentially woke up a few days later in a hospital situation. And it was pretty serious. It involved me then having to have some plates put into my forehead and so on. But so essentially, from my parents' perspective, that was the end of me riding out horses again, or indeed working hands-on with horses. But in a sort of an interesting development, the gentleman that I worked for just came to the hospital with a huge collection of books about horse racing and pedigrees and history of horse racing in Ireland and the UK and so on. And I spent the entire summer just reading these books and became completely enthralled in this sport as it now became to me. So something that I wasn't hands-on with anymore, but it was a sport. My parents were very much encouraging me to go down the route of, sort of, let's call it a civilian life, a non-horse life. And I duly did that. I went to university in Waterford and I did business and legal studies in university. And when I finished that, I went into a normal corporate job. I worked for one of the telco companies in Ireland. And worked my way up there right up until sort of the crash, which happened in sort of 09, 10. And I got laid off in 2010. Took off on a bit of a world tour to visit and travel and so on, and found myself in early or September 2011 in New Zealand for the Rugby World Cup. A 6 week trip turned into 3 years. Met my now wife during that particular time, and she ended up moving to Cambridge in the UK, and I duly followed. Now, obviously, geographically, Cambridge is located next door to Newmarket. We failed to find anywhere to live in Cambridge, so we ended up renting a house quite close to the English National Stud. And this sort of sparked an idea in my head that I'd been out of racing for such a long time, but ultimately, the farm that was at home, I would have liked to turn that into something to do with horses. And here I was next door. And rather than going down to London and continuing a corporate career and so on, I decided to go down to the English National Stud and asked them for a job. And they were more than accommodating to anybody who wanted to come and pick up a fork and learn what was what down there. I met a gentleman, similar name to myself, whose name was Rob Stapleton. And he was very obliging. He took me in, and essentially I spent a season there learning the whatnots of the breeding side of the industry. But during that season, I met two gentlemen. I met a gentleman called Brendan Boyle, who was a bloodstock. He ran a stud farm with the one side of Newmarket and did quite a bit of trading and kept quite a lot of the Rabba horses, which would be an interlink with Godolphin. And he looked after them for the breeding season and so on. So I ended up doing some work with him, which was fascinating because I learned quite a lot about pedigrees, confirmation of horses, the breeding side of things. And you were surrounded by exceptionally good quality stock, which was this rabbit stock. And then I also met a gentleman called Richard Venn, who was and still is probably the largest independent broker of stallion deals in the world. And I was fascinated by what he did because he bought and sold jumps horses, national hunt horses, and flat horses. He did stallions, he did horses in training, he did broodmares, he did everything. And I was amazed that there was a role there where you could actually, to steal the name of your own podcast, the business of bloodstock, which was something you weren't hands-on, but you were dealing with. So having a background in business myself, and then having this passion for the animal that is the horse, I was fascinated by this. And I decided there and then that I was going to investigate this more. And thankfully, both of those gentlemen educated me quite a lot in pedigrees and confirmation. And Richard in particular gave me a good leg up into the industry that when he moved or sort of segued into solely doing stallion deals, he gave me a couple of his regular horses and training clients. And this would have been back in 2017. And luckily, the first dozen or so horses that I would have bought for either of those clients went on to be quite successful. And then business sort of snowballed from there. So I would go to all the sales, I would be very active in purchasing what we would call value horses, essentially to take from the from the UK and on sale to other markets. So that takes us up to 2017, and that went right up until 2020, when I and my wife, our first child, was born. And of course, we had COVID. We were in Ireland at this particular time. We were back living in my locality, and we were breeding a couple of horses as well. But COVID hits, and the sort of the draconian measures of Ireland paled in comparison to the fact that there was no COVID at the time in New Zealand. And my wife suggested that we up sticks and go back there for a couple of months because there was nothing going on. All the sales had become digital and online and so on. So we did that and we came back in early 2021. And my wife fell back in love with New Zealand. And ever since, we've effectively done a 6 month and 6 month rotation where we luckily spend January to June in the Southern Hemisphere, and we spend July to December in the Northern Hemisphere. And that ties in very nicely with the sales calendars in both hemispheres.
The fact that you're someone who obviously loves to learn, you love to listen and love to just take on new knowledge. You know, a lot of us in this industry know that it's the type of space where you do learn something new every day. The industry constantly evolves and changes, and to do what you do in your role, it's something that you have to adapt to as well. And you mentioned there about you've made it work, especially for your lifestyle. 6 months in the Southern Hemisphere, then 6 months in the Northern Hemisphere. But then there's also the business aspect to it as well. So how do you plan your yearly schedule with your work clients and making sure that you actually have the clients ready for each sale? Like, you attend a lot of sales throughout the year, so you must have a lot of clients as well to be able to buy all these different types of sales. Not every sale is the same.
Absolutely not. Essentially, the business is divided into two separate and in some ways opposite categories. In the Northern Hemisphere, my business model is high volume, lower value horses is essentially what they are. And what we're doing is we're buying horses from the Premier League of Ireland and the UK, and we're on selling them to the first, second, third, fourth and fifth divisions that are below that. That's essentially the business model. So it's high volume. The main sales for that are obviously the Tarasos horses and training sale at the end of October. And then there's a May sale and there's a July sale. The May sale itself sort of piggybacks on one of the ready-to-run sales. So it's not a massive one that can't be dealt with from a distance. But when I'm back there from June onwards, that's sort of the concentration of sales. And most of my clients are seeking to buy in that particular part of the year. They're not necessarily seeking to buy in the first half of the year. That said, I do regularly purchase from the Tattersalls online sale, for example, which is now running monthly. And in the Southern Hemisphere, it's the opposite. It's sort of much higher value horses, but at much lower volumes. You don't have the other markets to unsell horses from, with Australia, New Zealand. Everything is quite, you know, internal. Obviously, if you've got horses good enough to go to Hong Kong, that's a market that we definitely target, and I'll come to that in a couple of moments. So what I've done, rather than being a sort of a horses in training agent down here, I have more so become a pinhooker and a pinhooker syndicate runner of weanling to yearling, and indeed more and more so now yearling to two-year-old horses. So different markets. I don't run any investment pinhook syndicates in the Northern Hemisphere currently. It's just facilitating that sort of foreign market desire for a horse, whereas down here it's completely different. And in both cases, we would certainly buy a number of end user horses from the yearling sales, both in the Northern Hemisphere and the Southern Hemisphere, but nothing sort of in comparison to sort of the volume of horses that we do in the horses in training. And to give you an example, in 2025, I would have shipped almost 200 horses out of Ireland and the UK over the period of those 12 months. In addition to that, we would buy 20, 25 from the horses and training sales. So there's a lot of volume, and it takes up sort of the mainstay of my business and in the Northern Hemisphere, which I still run when I'm in the Southern Hemisphere. But the Southern Hemisphere then is very much the yearling sales, which run from January to May, as we're aware, and then the weaning sales, which we're looking forward to again this year, from May obviously, and the Great Southern in June.
This episode is brought to you by Morgan and English Commercial Lawyers, more than just a law firm. They work like external in-house counsel, getting to know you and your business. With offices in Sydney, Scone and Tamworth, and years of experience in the agriculture and thoroughbred industries, Morgan and English deliver practical solutions that work in the real world. Whether it's contracts, disputes, or big picture advice, they're the kind of firm you want in your corner.
We're talking big numbers there, Ed. I guess something that is associated with the industry all too often, I guess, is trends and in fashion or fickleness. I think they could be associated to a lot of different industries, but in ours, it can obviously heavily affect sale ring results. Do you think these trends and in fashion sales drive prices in the ring, firstly, and as an effect, change the way that we look at second and third season sires?
Absolutely. It's a fashion business. It's an entertainment business, and it's always going to be a fashion business. And I would have to hold my hand up and say that when we go to Easter, for example, this weekend, we will ultimately be going to try buy a trade horse or two that's exceptionally well bred that might fall through the cracks that will ultimately end up in Hong Kong. So you're being directed by what's going to be desired in Hong Kong. In the last couple of seasons, for our, even for our weanling to yearling market, we're always buying with the idea of a Hong Kong end user client. So for example, 2023, we purchased the first Castelvecchio that was then unsold here in New Zealand. Sorry, to be fair, he was one of three that was sold in New Zealand, but he's the first one that's ended up in Hong Kong. In 2024, we did the same with Brutal. We bought a couple of those that have ended up in Hong Kong. 2025, we've done it with Portland Sky. So these were sort of emerging stallions that you hope are going to have a fashion tag at some point. And that's ultimately what's happened with those into Hong Kong. And they need to continue on and do something. So yes, absolutely. However, that doesn't exist in the sort of the trade horses or the horses in training market. It's obviously what the horse has done itself on the track. That's what you're buying. And I get great satisfaction out of buying horses for markets where they simply want to race and enjoy horses. So the turning it into a trade horse, that doesn't exist. So for example, I would sell a lot of horses to Germany, Belgium, the Netherlands, where they solely race them for the fun and the sport of it. And then quite a few horses to the Middle East, which is very much a case of, well, there's no gambling for a start. So it's my horse is better than your horse. And yes, they have preferential sires that work and act on their types of surfaces that they have, but it's not the fashion ends that we would have obviously at the yearling sales down here, for example, or the yearling sales in Europe.
That's, I think, such a good answer there. And you mentioned something about the Middle East, you know, my horse is better than your horse. And that's in effect why racing started, was, you know, two people, you know, had a horse each, and you wanted to obviously run it and see whose horse could do better. So I think you handled that very succinctly.
Absolutely. And it does really go back to that first story I was telling you about this small farmer and this small owner with this horse who had this potential for what in our eyes at the time was this the greatest thing that ever happened in the community sort of thing. And that resonates a lot with me still. I would buy a lot of horses in the 2,000 to 5,000 guineas price bracket that are for those end users. And I get such a kick out of, we've had a horse called Sea of Marengo, which has almost won a group three in Germany, ended up being placed, but he took those owners on such a great little adventure for them. I've had a gentleman in the in Belgium who solely wanted to win one massive festival race every summer, and we sourced a mare for him called Lady Magda, which I think she might have cost six. She would have been over the budget for him, and she ended up winning that 3 years in a row. And that's the fun that I get, the satisfaction that I get out of it. Not taking the slightest from anybody who manages to buy a slipper winner or indeed a Hong Kong winner for the Derby. And shout out to my good friend Bryce Tankard, who managed to source that horse with Kilgrave and sell it up there. And actually, Bryce is one of those examples of people that when we buy horses down here in the Southern Hemisphere, we target those sort of end users in mind. And Bryce, in the last 3 years, has ended up buying a colt that we would have put through our draft to go that particular process as well. So, yeah.
Ed, you just touched on there the importance of community. And I think we've seen it before where, you know, we've seen different videos of horses kind of coming up the street in Ireland, particularly after they've won a great race. And I think anywhere in the world, I think horse racing is so important for the community, where it's a social aspect like that, or, you know, regional country racetracks where it stimulates the economy. So I think, you know, you've touched on that really well as well, and that importance of community. But I'll hand you over to Justin now to jump back in.
One interesting point, just if you want to contrast the difference between Ireland and New Zealand, for example. So in Ireland, the sort of the psyche of everyday life is that we are all surrounded by horses. And it comes to the fore when we see that on our main evening news every day, there will be the horse racing results. And they will show, they'll highlight, they'll champion those who have done well, particularly if we manage to go to the UK and, you know, beat the English at something. That'll be the main headline. In New Zealand, having had a 16-year relationship with New Zealand now, I have seen the mainstream news here talk about horse racing three times. The first one was when Sir Patrick Hogan died, which essentially was a roundabout story to do with horse racing. Then we have Brendan Lindsay and Katrina Williams were both in the honours list. It made the news. And it made the news here at the weekend when James McDonald hit the 130 Group 1 wins. But that's the only time you will see racing as part of the general news population here in New Zealand. And that's very disappointing. And then at the same time, I think we have a number of issues that are currently going on here with the closure of, or the potential closure of, these community tracks and places that have festival events maybe once a year or twice a year. And this is going to be a major issue, I think, in New Zealand. But the point about it is that horse racing is still one of the few events that you and a group of friends can decide to attend this afternoon and make that decision in the morning. You know, you can't all decide to go to the cricket or the rugby because you need tickets, or a concert or an event. And chances are, if you do manage to get the tickets, well, they'll be in different places. It's one of the few events that you can still go and enjoy as a group of people at very, very short notice. And to be fair to Ellerslie, which is has now done its redevelopment, it's a fantastic facility, a fantastic track. And my hope is that that's going to continue on the trajectory that they've built already to make that a massive event, essentially every second Saturday, or indeed every third Saturday, as it may be. So that's exciting to see. And I would love to think that horse racing would sort of get to that community in a entertainment sense, if you can call it that, in a big city like Auckland is, that is sort of resonates with the massive festivals that we would have in Europe, and particularly Ireland and the UK.
Something you've said there, Ed, as well, is that community feel, and it's something that, you know, it should be a great thing for locals to attend, or just people in the area to get to over a weekend and socialise and just associate themselves to the great sport that we do have. But as from the multiple conversations I've had with you, Ed, of course, at the sales, one thing you do love doing is going to the races at the sales that you attend and being there on a Saturday, whether or not you have horses involved or clients there. You love being there at the racetrack, and I think that just shows, you know, the fabric, especially of what you're talking about, and I guess you hold yourself accountable to making sure that you're supporting the industry that you love and work in as well.
Absolutely, 100%. I mean, first and foremost, we all have to love the sport that is racing, and the poetry in motion that is two horses or more running against each other, and the competitiveness of that. I am not a massive punter. I admire people who do; that's their take. But I can enjoy rugby, soccer, and many other sports without necessarily having a punt on it. And horse racing is just the same. In fact, horse racing probably has more permutations, more chessboard pieces with breeding and the teams of trainers, jockeys, etc., that make it a fascinating sport without ever being a punter. So thoroughly, thoroughly enjoy that, and like the opportunity to go and enjoy racing as often as possible. Saturday coming, hopefully we'll be racing in Sydney once again and enjoying that. And they're fantastic social events. And, you know, there's, as I said, there's nothing greater for a group of people to go and do, even at last minute notice, than go and enjoy an afternoon's racing.
Now, obviously in this industry, and especially in your field, there are a lot of bloodstock agents out there per se, but what actually makes a good bloodstock agent in your eyes, other than, you know, the obvious of finding winners?
I think being able to have 50 things going on at one time, knowing that possibly only one of them will become successful, being able to deal with that. It's dealing with it's managing and dealing with the people as opposed to the product itself, which is the horses. I think we can all educate ourselves on pedigrees, trends, form, but the ability to engage with people, to encourage them to make decisions when they need to make decisions, or indeed have them trust you that your advice is going to be valuable to them. I think that's the key. And I think in my own circumstance, I've benefited a lot from having a career that was previous to this particular industry to actually learn and hone those skills. You know, I certainly do quite large deals in the private market when it comes to horses, but they would pale in comparison to some of the bigger infrastructure deals we would have done in corporate world previously. But the skill set is the exact same. It's how you deal and manage with the people. And thankfully, I would say on the whole, people in the horse racing world are some of the best you could possibly ever encounter.
I'd agree with that. I think I always think about the people in this industry, and there are so many people who are just willing to help one another out. And again, coming back to that theme of community, it's such a fab industry for so many fantastic people. So we've all been there, Ed. We've been in the ring. We've got a horse that we're about to bid on, getting a little bit to the top end of the budget. You know, souring emotions can be high. Someone wants to keep putting their hand up. How do you protect your clients from overspending? Do you have any boundaries that you might set?
Yes, absolutely. I'm a firm believer in putting a value on something before you go into the ring. Now, if we're buying something, obviously, to on trade, that's a little more easily done, because you essentially, the day you buy the horse is the day you sell the horse. That's the ultimate rule in this, in that you need to buy it at a value that you know you can incur your costs and then potentially make a profit from that. If I have a client at the sales who simply wants a horse, that is a beautiful position to be in. That is fantastic. And somebody who, by virtue of them employing your skills, has been far more successful in life than you have yourself. And they're great people whose company to be in. And I fully encourage them to steal another slogan, buy the horse you want. Absolutely. You know, and go and do it. Because life is short. You need to enjoy it. And if you've been lucky enough to fall into a world where you could potentially enjoy that through horses, that's a wonderful thing. So I wouldn't hold anybody back that's there with me. If somebody's on the phone with me, I'd slightly lesser. I would probably manage their expectations a bit better. But I've never discouraged a client unless I can see some nefarious thing going on, which happens, to be fair. And look, it happens in all walks of life. If I can see that something is going on, I can 10 times out of 10, I'll advise the client, no, I think we hold back here. And I can guarantee you 10 times out of 10, we end up buying that horse, same horse outside the ring for less than we would have bid on it, or less than we were planning to bid on it in the ring anyway. So, yeah, but no, I would never curtail somebody's enthusiasm in the ring. Absolutely not.
That is, that's a very fair way to go about that, Justin. Mm.
Now, especially given that you work on both sides of the world, you're very exposed to the large array of stallions that we have across in the Southern Hemisphere and the Northern Hemisphere, and we see them all around the world. But in Australia, we see a lot of shuttle stallions, especially at some of these bigger farms. How important are they to both the Australian and New Zealand market?
Exceptionally important. The industry itself is becoming more condensed every day, simply by technology. So whereas before, if you were an admirer of horse racing in Australia and New Zealand, that was probably your only access to it. Your only visual representation was probably that. Now I think you can watch racing anywhere. So if you take a comparison with the soccer world, everybody knows who Manchester United are. Everybody knows who Barcelona and Madrid are. So therefore, everybody should know who I'm Invincible is. Everybody should know who Home Affairs is, or indeed vice versa, Franco, or See the Stars in the Northern Hemisphere. And that's the mainstay of our business, and I hope that continues. The shuttle stallions are exceptionally important. Having what I would call a European eye, I always gravitate towards the stock that they sort of produce at the sales. Not saying that there's a massive difference between them, but there's a couple of nuances that you can see between Northern Hemisphere stallions and Southern Hemisphere stallions and what they produce in the typical. But no, it's exceptionally important. I would love to see it continue. I would love to see some more Australian sprint stallions going back up to Europe. That would be fantastic. Or indeed, one of them ended up going to the US. You know. So it's the world is very small when it comes to the breeding now. So the more of it that continues, I think that can only be a positive for the industry.
Absolutely, I agree with you. We talked about trends earlier. Do you think at the moment the market is leaning a particular way with a horse with a really nice pedigree or a horse with the right physical? And is one more important to you than the other?
If personally, I will always choose physical over pedigree. That said, the nature of any business is if you're buying something to retrade, unfortunately, the first thing you have to achieve is getting somebody to look at your horse. And I think the trends have gone to the point where a number of stallions are automatically discounted because they are ex-stallion, or somebody else takes a position. Well, when I try to unsell that, my clients are not going to be interested in that sort of stallion. So being stubborn about loving physicals is not going to help your pocket in that regard, unfortunately. So the trends are, yes, it's a case of what can I unsell the next day? Who's going to want to look at my horse? Because if it doesn't come out of the box, nobody's going to see the physical anyway.
No, I do agree. I think it's you've got to have a balance of both there, don't you, realistically?
You do. Unfortunately, you do. That said, I'll give you a small example. When I have free reign to source a horse for clients, I had a horse that's Arcana, just gone. We had the Arcana Summer Sale has a breeze up element to the sale. Essentially, they're horses that have had issues in breeze ups previously in that year. So the fact that they've ended up there is unfortunate for the vendor in the first place. But there was one horse, he couldn't breeze at all. His breeze is hilarious in that he goes from side to side. He can't go forward. Felt essentially sorry for the vendor, not the reason we bought the horse, but this particular horse was already named, and he was named, I forget this right, in French, it's ni oui ni non, which basically means neither yes or no. And I thought that was hilarious in my limited understanding of French. It was, well, I'm looking at this horse and he's telling me his name is neither yes nor no. And I totally agree. I don't know what you are. Is it a horse that I would buy, or are you not a horse that I would buy? But I took him out of the box because nobody looked at him, and he went through the ring and he was unsold. And I took him out of the box four or five times, and he had a really nice action to him. And I thought to myself, the only problem you have is you can't run straight. But I know a trainer who can make you run straight. So I rang one of my trainers in the Netherlands and I said, look, there's this horse here. He's by Typerian, completely unfashionable stallion. You may not have ever heard of him. Typerian, a very unfashionable stallion. We ended up buying the horse for 3,000 euros, which is what the vendor wanted. No issue there. The horse went to my trainer in Belgium, actually. He's not the Netherlands, Belgium. And he came back and won a race in France last Friday. He won a 20,000 euro race last Friday because this man has gone and sorted it. Now, he's an example of a man who was not looking for a fashionable stallion, just wanted a horse to do a job, and we managed to find one to do that, and hopefully he'll continue on and, you know, be just as successful for him in the next few races. So yeah, it doesn't always have to be one camp or the other.
No, and I think that's a really interesting story. I'm glad he worked out. But I think there's so much in the industry now around like tech and data and different analytics. Yes. And if you really applied all of those resources, you probably wouldn't have bought him. You know, the breeze up, he's not doing a good job in that, he's not running the way he should have. Is there one resource though that you do find yourself using in terms of those kind of more techie data sides that's like a must have when you're buying horses?
Yes, I would put a lot of weight on what previous progeny of a mare has made in a very simple sense. I like the idea of the biomechanics. I think any trend or pattern that you can find and what has worked for you, you will probably want to go back to that well and purchase from it again. I don't like the idea of the sort of a one glove fits all scenario. There's one particular company who are sort of promoting themselves very recently as being the, just give us the catalog page and we'll tell you everything you need to know about this type of horse. I think that's probably gone a bit too far, and all you're going to end up with is them giving the same answer to everybody. It's like if one vet vetted every single horse at the sale, then you just have that one result. My own take is I would prefer, ultimately as a bloodstock agent, people are really, they're ultimately paying you for an opinion. That is it, nothing more. How you generate that opinion, it comes from many different facets. Someone like John Foote or a Paul Willetts, I think, will beat an AI machine any day of the week looking at a single catalog page, because they will have memory of every other progeny and second dam and the third dam that they will have seen. And I think that will never be replicated. And the objective of a good bloodstock agent is to sort of get to that point where you have a memory of what everything else looked like, and does this horse look the same as that? Whereas AI, yes, does things. Does things, I guess it speeds things up. I will say one thing where I have embraced it myself is that with a high volume of horses in training, I do on my own, through my own website portal, it allows my clients to log in and look at form on horses. Now, in the UK, for example, we have At the Races and we have Racing TV. And if you want to watch replays from a particular horse unless you have a Racing Post subscription, which I very much encourage, but not everybody does if it's not their if it's not their everyday thing, and you know, if it's a small trainer in the Netherlands, for example. What AI has allowed me to do is send somebody a profile with the links to the official replay, be that on Racing TV or be that on At the Races. And AI allows me to quickly sort of put that together for them. So it condenses it into one thing. It also allows me to pull in the sales returns for that particular family so that they can see it there in one particular thing, rather than previously spending a lot of time for doing that sort of thing. So yeah, there's absolute benefits to it. I think it will take off in our industry a lot. I think a lot of people will buy into it. And I think ultimately it will still all fall back on, well, whose opinion do I want to pay for?
Yep. I think you're right. I think AI and tech has a place, but I also think, you know, going back to that horse you just talked about, AI is not going to know that you have a trainer in your account that can help or resolve or train that horse and take that risk. So I completely agree with you there.
Yeah. And I think as well, when we have the current issue of smaller fall crops in both hemispheres, it is becoming, I mean, really all we're doing is we're making that shortlist very, very short. If we start using all of these tools, you have to be, you have to be a trainer, I think, nowadays, who is prepared to forgive on something. You know, compromise is going to be the name of the game going forward. And just ending up in a situation where you have an owner that has forked out for a subscription to a particular AI service and is giving you a list, well, ultimately, they're not paying for your opinion. They're just paying for you to go through the motions. And that's not going to be good for anybody.
Absolutely.
Now, Ed, especially in your world of being a bloodstock agent, how does things like online sales affect your job? Obviously, it's a lot harder to go out and, you know, inspect some of these horses put up online. I know there's opportunities for certain mares that go up online to go to farms and see them. But seemingly, especially over the last couple of years, the online selling of horses has become so prevalent and seemingly an important thing for the industry. But from your perspective, what do you make of the online sales?
I'm a 100% adapter of the online sales. To a certain point, I think it works very well for breeding stock. It works well for, in fact, all elements. I do partake actively in the horses and training sales, which are monthly with Tattersalls, for example. However, I will caveat that by saying, if I didn't already have a very good relationship with the vast majority of the vendors, it wouldn't be my first place to go to try purchase a horse. And what I mean by that is, a horse in training, I would much prefer physically be able to inspect it, taking somebody else's opinion on it or trusting their view on it is something I think you definitely have to take with a, you know, caveat emptor, or emptor as it is very important when it comes to buying the horses. So I fully believe in it. The Tattersalls online sale presents a small issue for me in that, to do full due diligence for my clients, the facility to then re-vet a horse after the sale is great. However, when you've done your shortlist, you need to then find veterinary facilities in all sorts of places where you can potentially vet that horse within 24 hours. And it frustrates me to no end. Actually, that's not fair. It doesn't frustrate me, but I would much prefer to head a day earlier in the week. They normally have it on a sort of a Wednesday and a Thursday. I'd much prefer that on a Tuesday and a Wednesday. So then at least you had a Thursday, or at least a late Wednesday and a Thursday to get that betting sorted or make an arrangement. But suddenly it's into Saturday. If you've got a horse that's in some, you know, far off place in Scotland, it's hard to get a vet there to do it. So it becomes a bit of a you know, if you, a proper agent was doing their due diligence, you end up taking horses off that you possibly would have bought if it was a physical sale, simply because you can't follow through on the due diligence after the sale, if that makes sense.
Yep, absolutely. That makes complete sense. And I think that goes to show as well the importance of the role of a bloodstock agent in the industry as well, is that it is a role and a career in the industry that is still very much needed and something that isn't going to disappear anytime soon.
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, the way I position myself is that I'm dealing with people who are coming to the industry because they want the entertainment from it. They are busy with their own lives. Chances are, if you have the proceeds or funds to spend on horses, well, they have come from something else that you've been doing in your business world that's suddenly not going to change. You're not going to find time in your own world. You'll have opinions, absolutely, but to have that intermediary who will make sure that you're being looked after in this particular scenario and your best interests are being looked after will forever be a requirement in this industry. Absolutely. Yes, indeed. I would also say that the online sales are most welcome in that they generate a bit of regular excitement. So, for example, I have one client who's based in Christchurch. He's become a good friend. We're actually both from Ireland. I joke about him that he has a Gavel House addiction. So he will ring me every Monday and say, "Oh, did you see such and such on Gavel House?" And I find myself talking him out of things that I can see are going to be issues in the future. But sometimes he comes up with an absolute gem, and we ended up buying a horse together last year for 4,500. It was a horse, a mare in foal to a sort of state, and we ended up selling that horse at the yearling sale this year in a partnership, and we got a great result out of it. So it's good that that happens and people pay attention to it. It's an online market for anything is a very, very welcome thing, and I hope it continues in the pace that it's doing.
Absolutely. I think it's only going to get bigger, and I think more and more people are adopting it, and like you said, COVID had a very strong helping hand in that, so it'd be interesting to see how it progresses. In the Australasian market, what do you feel as though the market could learn from Europe and vice versa?
Oh, very interesting. It's much easier answer the vice versa bit. I think there's a lot that the European market can learn from Australia and New Zealand, which they are doing anyway. You know, the syndicates, for example, this is, I'm not the first person to preach about this, but you do it very well in Australia. They do it very well here in New Zealand. And the very fact that they are regulated to an extent is fantastic. That needs to be a thing that happens in Europe. It gives people peace of mind to get involved. The fractional ownership, I'm not against it at all. The more people who have any sort of a claim to a horse that's running in a race is not a bad thing. So I think that's what we could do. We can definitely do better. I think you have essentially an open course scenario in that you can go to most race courses and you don't feel like you're a second class citizen because you're in a particular enclosure and not the other. I like that the general dress code is certainly of a certain level, but doesn't really overdo it to the extent that you could claim it possibly does in some of the courses in the UK. I think Ireland and Australia are very similar, that we don't have that sort of, I'm not going to call it classism, but you know, you can, if you go to the Curra, for example, you can sort of access 99% of places with a general admission ticket, which is good. What can Australia and New Zealand learn from Europe? Going back to that, certainly in New Zealand, embracing the sport and championing those who have gone and done well. You know, the Chris Wallers, James McDonald, people like that. You know, we celebrate such smaller sports here in New Zealand that take up so much airspace that it frustrates me somewhat when you have world champions effectively, you know, being world champions every weekend, not being championed in the mainstream. Maybe all that will solve itself with, social media and so on. But I do feel probably that just silos people into what they're interested in anyway. You know, they're never going to get the new thing if they're not seeing it in sort of mainstream news. But no, I think there's a lot that is done very well in Australia and New Zealand. And I think that should continue. And there's a lot we can learn from it in Europe. Yeah, I genuinely do. It's imbalanced.
Now, being someone who attends multiple sales around the world, no doubt you've been bidding on thousands of horses across your time in the sport. But is there a particular story of, you know, as listeners, we love these, but maybe not yourself, but the one that got away, that horse that you didn't quite put your hand up that one extra time that you could have landed that may have gone on to be a Group 1 winner?
Justin, there are lots of those, but I made a conscious decision early on in business to not get bogged down in stuff that got away. For as far as I was concerned, if you did not end up buying it, it was good luck to the person that did. You'd chalk it down and you'd say, oh yeah, if that could have worked out differently, but you end up just frustrating yourself or confusing or conflicting that particular client next time around when you say, oh, if we had gone and done that, or if we had gone and then done that. So I don't have any particular, story, but I will tell you not a one that got away in the sales ring, but way back when I first started to follow horse racing, the assumption that you have, well, okay, from following this and you have all this information about it, yeah, I'll have a punt, or I'll use the information that I have to have a punt. And I had somewhat of a successful little role for a period of time up until the Champion Stakes Day in 2001. You probably weren't even born, Justin, but that particular Champion Stakes Day in Ireland was Galileo and Fantastic Light. And I had a considerable amount of money rolling onto this horse called Galileo that in my mind could not be beaten. He was the greatest thing since sliced bread. I'd followed Coolmore and Aidan O'Brien. I used to read the Racing Post when I was in free time in school. And it was this, my parents used to encourage me to go racing. And I had a considerable amount of money for my age on this particular horse. And the outcome of the race is he got beaten at very short nose by Fantastic Light. Galileo went on to be a phenomenal stallion that I see in pedigrees every day of the week. And it reminds me of this every time. I've never had a proper punt since. I learned that harsh lesson proper and well, what's it, 25 years ago at this stage. But yeah, it's not a case of the one that got away, but every time I see that pop up, he reminds me of how much money he lost me that day. And sometimes I buy horses that he's also... So I blame him for, you know, me losing money on those particular trade horses or client horses as well. So I don't know if that answers your question, but that's it's a more fun one to tell you.
That's brilliant.
The day I met Galileo was such a pinchy moment in Feathered. It was just incredible story and one of my, I think, career highlights. So I can imagine you were very upset with yourself and Galileo that day, unfortunately.
I had lost a considerable amount of money for the age of the person I was at the time, but it was a lesson hard learned. It had been money that had been accumulated from what I assumed was my foolproof system, you know, and you realize that that's kind of silly. I grew up with the Aidan O'Brien and the Coolmore sort of juggernaut that it was, and here we had these people who were on the world stage, you know, flying the Irish flag, and it was great and fantastic. So my disappointment was quickly put to one side when, you know, they would go on and win a Breeders' Cup, or they, you know, Aidan O'Brien went on to have the fantastic career in the noughties that he had beyond that point. So yeah, it's just it's my memory of gambling. When people ask me now, do you gamble on horses? I say, well, I do. I say, you know, I don't gamble in the traditional punt sense, but you know, being purchasing trade horses to on sale, you're effectively taking 100 grand gambles to turn a horse into 200 before it ever sees the race course. So ultimately, it's still a gamble. We like to think it's a little more nuanced and educated and in our control. But yeah, slightly, I still gamble, but just not in the same traditional way.
No, I think a lot of people would probably resonate with that, Ed. Absolutely. Okay. Now, what is something that you've learned about this industry that you wish you could have told yourself when you started?
Oh, it's the gateway to the world. It's the gateway to traveling and seeing the world. It's a fantastic community of people who know people and people who will help you all along the way. Now, that said, I will balance that again saying, I am happy I came into it in the later in life element that I did, in that I did manage to have a career before this, because I think that's enabled me to sort of my basic understanding of your own story, Charmaine. It's like you've had a very busy 10 years. You know, I've been the same. I think if I had come into this many moons ago, I possibly would have gone in a different direction and would be more hands-on and running a farm or have my own farm. And that would have been fine too. But I do joke that I enjoy the drug dealer approach to the industry that I have now, which is essentially you buy it, you sell it, you clip the ticket, but you never touch the product. And I like that. Essentially, that's the business of the bloodstock. And I enjoy that. However, going back to your specific question, one thing that's fantastic about this industry is that it enables people to travel and work in the industry worldwide and in a sort of a safe environment. Everybody will know somebody at the next farm, somebody you can recommend them to, someone that you can suggest you go work for this person. And you really are only limited by your own dedication and work ethic to it. You know, the Godolphin Flying Start is a fantastic thing. But while that takes 12 every year, there's 120 people who go and do their own version of the Godolphin Flying Start, and good on them, and long may that continue. So yeah, it's the greatest little industry in the world for very many, many facets. And late and all as I am to it, I'm delighted I finally discovered it and I'm stuck into it.
I think that's a really nice nice little piece there. And I think, you know, Ed, what you're saying about, you know, maybe not coming into the industry, you know, and being in corporate before, I think there's a lot of benefits there. And I think the other thing that you touched on around the Godolphin Flying Start, I think if I had started, you know, if it was a career option provided to me in school, or say I did my education in Ireland and went down that path, I probably would have been maybe down a different path. But I think to, you know, the other 120 that don't make it on Godolphin Flying Start, there's absolutely other roles and other opportunities available. So it's, you know, you look back on things, and like you said, 10 years been busy, but it's only when you look back, you go, oh, that makes sense, and that makes sense. It's only that, the beauty of hindsight.
Just to touch on that as well, the other side of it is there are so many people who are successful and exist in the industry who are more than willing to be helpful to anybody else who's trying to come along. And that, I don't think that exists in every industry. You know, if you take somebody like Johnny McKeever, for example, he hugely successful, also does the 6 months and 6 months. Johnny would enjoys nothing more than somebody who is keen to follow him around sales and get an insight to what he does. And he is one of many, you know, Bruce Slade, the same. The Bloodstock Agents Federation in Australia seem to be very proactive in that regard. I'm a new member of the Bloodstock Agents Federation here in New Zealand, and that's definitely something we're keen to do as well. I run a yearling tour here every first week of January every year for the Karaka sales. And it was very noticeable this year that we had young people who wanted to come along. So I'd have people contact me and say, look, I'm not an active buyer per se, but I'm really keen to see some farms and see the stock. And I couldn't have been more encouraging of those people to come and do it. So it's a fantastic industry. I think you're, as I say, you're limited only by yourself. You know, there's plenty of help and assistance out there from so many people who would show you how it is that they do things.
Yeah, I agree. I think as well, you know, probably when I was a bit younger, and sometimes I still can be a little bit shy. And I think, you know, actually asking people and saying, you know, a lot of people who know me wouldn't say that, by the way, but, you know, just saying, hey, Ed, do you know what? Can I spend an afternoon with you? Do you have the time, please? And I think that is the biggest, I think I love that so much about the industry, that people are genuinely happy to give back and encourage new people to come through. Like you said, you don't get that in many, many other industries, or even the corporate world. I think, Ed, it can be so cutthroat at times, as opposed to wanting everyone to learn so the industry can be better as a whole. I think that's really special.
Yeah, and it follows on in that there's room for everybody. You know, we don't have a world where, I'm sure it exists, but in my own silo of it, we don't have a world where bloodstock agents are ripping each other's throats out. You know, everybody's there to assist everybody else. I would do a huge amount of business with other bloodstock agents because they manage clients in different areas or different jurisdictions and so on and so forth. So that's, I think there's, you can put yourself in a position where you can be very successful. I would say, but we do have an imbalance slightly though in the sort of the male female end of things when it comes to, I guess, what would we call them? Sort of the let's call them the end user jobs or the career jobs that people want to find themselves ending up in. We would have a huge amount of females who work hands-on with horses, and they would have career trajectories that I think it would be great to see quite a few more of them end up as bloodstock agents and things like that. Should that be their desire? We definitely have an imbalance there, I think, and hopefully that'll change as things progress.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd like to think it will change, and the tides are definitely coming. But I think that's also important. And I think the one thing we haven't touched on is on the hands-on side. That is absolutely skill work. I know a lot of people kind of say, oh, you know, you've got the corporate and you've got the ancillary or admin roles. But, you know, those roles being with horses and knowing, you know, why a horse might be injured or all of those other intricate nuances. You know, and I said this before, a lot of administrators couldn't put a halter on a horse. Or get a horse into a float who's refusing to load, all of those things. It's such a skilled, intricate role that I don't think necessarily gets as much recognition as it should. And I know we've got things like, you know, the Stable and Staff Awards, which are fantastic. But as a whole, it's such a, you know, could I do some of those things hands-on necessarily, the more absolutely not, you know, we've got our horses there and whatnot, but you know, I think that needs to be called out as an industry as well, because I don't think it gets enough love by any stretch of the word.
Absolutely. You're 100% correct. And I would also say that a good leader at the sales is making far more money than the bloodstock agent that goes to the sales and doesn't buy anything. They're doing very well, and long may that continue. And you'll find that if there was an upper echelon of good leaders, they're most definitely predominantly female, and fair play to them. Fair play to them. So long may that continue.
Right. Well, we're going to jump into our game that we love to play. I escaped this on my podcast, Justin, but Fast Five. So
okay.
Round of five questions. First answer that comes to mind. So we're going to jump straight in. What is your favorite sale in the world to attend?
Abbotsford Horses and Training Sale, because I love the chaos.
Chaos, that doesn't shock me. Now, I've had a few of these on both sides of the globe with you, Ed, but where is the best pint of Guinness on the sales circuit?
Oh, I mean, look, I'd have to say the best pint of Guinness is definitely in Ireland. So let's just leave Ireland out of it. Crikey, that's a tough one. They're terrible everywhere. That's the bottom line. I would probably say, look, the Yard in Newmarket's does a decent enough one. That's my answer to the question. Yes, the Yard in Newmarket. They have the cold and the room temperature, and anywhere that sells the room temperature is okay in my book, because that's my tipple.
I wonder if that was the time that you both had a Guinness in the Yard together, Justin, where there's another story about a almost missed fight, which we might not have time to get into today. But if you see Justin asking about that. Favourite holiday destination?
Favourite holiday destination is actually Waiheke Island.
Who's been a mentor of yours in this industry?
So there's been so definitely Richard Venn. He gave me a massive leg up in the industry. And as I said, there was a gentleman called Brendan Boyle. And I would There's a lot of people. To this day, I have never met somebody who wouldn't give you the time of day, or wouldn't give you an opinion on something or advice on something. So it's a fantastic industry. But I've had to single out one person. Richard Venn.
And finally, what's one piece of advice you'd give to someone looking to pave their way into the industry?
Go for gold. You know, if you're at any stage of life, get yourself involved. If you happen to be younger, you have far more opportunity to get yourself out of problems if you things go wrong. But just do it, and don't wait around for something to fall in your lap. Go make your own luck. Go make your own way. There'll be something 100% there for you to do in this industry. So many options, and don't be afraid to ask questions of anybody or tag along or want to tag along, and just get yourself involved.
Great. Ed,
absolutely. Great piece of advice. And I think that's a great way to finish this podcast as well. Just, you know, if you do see anyone around at the sales that you feel that you might learn something new off or spend some time with, as Ed says, everyone's always very accommodating at the sales, and something that this industry is very good at is that creating opportunities for people to learn something and step into the game. So, Ed, thank you so much for coming on this podcast today. We really appreciate you taking the time out of your day to come on and have a chat to us. And we wish you all the best of luck for the upcoming yearling and breeding sales, and of course, when you do go back to the Northern Hemisphere as well.
Well, thank you very much, Justin. Appreciate it. It's been a real pleasure to be on the podcast, and I'm very excited for the future of the reins that you now hold, Charmaine, and taking this ANZ business of bloodstock and the auxiliary business forward. It's exciting times, and I wish you every success with it.
Thank you so much, Ed. It's a super exciting time, and I can't wait to see what the next chapter holds.